Maybe your government isn't always out for you. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's Jack Kennedy who's the one who's out for you. And they get to him first. So that means people should know more about the country they live in and the meaning of public relations and foreign policy, because they are involved and they can't keep it away by pushing it away. The same thing's true about the continued concealment of the murder of John Kennedy. They can't put it away. They have to confront it.
There wasn't no conspiracy, Jim. If there were, why the hell didn't Bobby Kennedy prosecute it as Attorney General? He was his brother, for Christ's sake. How the fuck all those people can keep a secret like that, I don't know.
But I want you to know, I'm going to call you in front of the grand jury. You lie to the grand jury. You've been lying to me. I'm going to charge you with perjury. Right now, I took 9 judges on right here in New Orleans, Dino. I beat them all. So am I communicating with you?
Is this off the record, Daddy-O? Good. In that case, let me sum it up for you real quick. If I answer that question you keep asking, if I give you the name of the big enchilada, you know, then it's Bon Voyage Dino. I mean like permanent. I mean like a bullet in my head, you dig? Your mouse fighting a gorilla. Kennedy's as dead as that crab meat. The government's still breathing. You want to line up with a dead man?
No lips, Dino. Either you dancing to the grand jury with the real identity of Claire Bertrand, or your fat behind's going to the slammer. Now you dig me?
You're as crazy as your mama. Goes to show it's in the genes. You have any idea what you're getting yourself into, Daddy-O? The government's gonna jump all over your head, Jimbo. Go cock-a-doodle-doo. Good day to you, sir.
All right, now we're going to be reading On the Trail of the Assassins by the wonderful, brilliant, what a hero, I can't say enough things, I don't want to get too far off, but Jim Garrison, the district attorney, I believe, from New Orleans, Louisiana in the 1960s, who, of course, the Oliver Stone's film JFK was based upon. Kevin Costner plays Jim Garrison in the film, and film is tremendous for people who are new to it. Probably not everything's correct, and I don't think that Jim Garrison had everything correct. What's amazing about Jim Garrison is that he was able to do and put together as much as he did so early on after the assassination. I believe it was in 1967 that he started bringing charges against people, including New Orleans businessman Clay Shaw, or Clay Bertrand, as he was known, and who later turned out to be part of and have contacts and business affiliations and tie-ins with Central Intelligence. Let me read the back of the book for you. This was published in 2012. So, a few years ago. Almost 50 years after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, his murder continues to haunt the American psyche and stands as a turning point in our nation's history. The Warren Commission rushed out its report in 1964, but questions continue to linger. Was there a conspiracy? Was there a coup at the highest levels of government? On March 1, 1967, New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison shocked the world by arresting local businessman Clay Shaw for conspiracy to murder the president. His alleged co-conspirator, David Ferry, had been found dead a few days before. Garrison charged that elements of the U.S. government, in particular the CIA, were behind the crime. From the beginning, his probe was virulently attacked in the media and violently denounced from Washington. His office was infiltrated and sabotaged, and witnesses disappeared and died strangely. Eventually, Shaw was acquitted after the briefest of jury deliberations and the only prosecution ever brought for the murder of President Kennedy was over. Returning to print for the first time in years, On the Trail of the Assassins, the primary source material for Oliver Stone's hit film JFK, is Garrison's own account of his investigations into the background of Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination of President Kennedy and his prosecution of Clay Shaw in the trial that followed. Jim Garrison was the district attorney of Orleans County, who rose to prominence during his investigations into the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. He passed away in October 1992. Wow, so this is the guy, really. You want to talk about the godfather of JFK researchers, investigators, even conspiracy theorists. This is it. This is the guy who started it all. I'm glad I have the chance and the opportunity to read the book here. And I hope you guys enjoy it. These books are long and painstaking, and most people probably don't care, but I thought while I have it here and while I'm interested, I'll go ahead and record it and share it with people, and it'll always be recorded. So there you go. I hope I don't get in trouble for reading it and sharing it on the air and essentially letting anyone have access to it without paying. I always hesitate about certain books, and Jim Garrison's dead, and I don't think who his heirs or whoever holds the rights to the book, I don't think they would mind. It's been 50 some years now that he probably wrote this book, and so I thought it'd be worth sharing with everybody. Okay, let's go to the introduction. This is not just another of the many books analyzing the dry evidence in the assassination of President Kennedy. It is, instead, a chronicle of the experiences of one man who tried to get to the truth about the murder and prosecute those responsible for it. I write not as a critic, but as a participant, a prosecutor, and an investigator. At the time of the assassination, on November 22, 1963, I was district attorney of New Orleans. Because the accused assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, had resided in New Orleans the summer before the assassination, I was immediately drawn into the case. More than 3 years later, in March 1967, my investigation culminated in the arrest of Clay Shaw, director of the International Trademark and fixture of New Orleans High Society, on charges of conspiracy to murder John Kennedy. In the months leading to Shaw's trial in 1969, I publicly suggested that members of the United States government's intelligence community, including Clay Shaw, were responsible for the assassination and had carried it out in order to stop President Kennedy's efforts to break with Cold War foreign policy. While the jury accepted my argument that there had been a conspiracy, it was not then aware of Shaw's role as a clandestine CIA operative. Unconvinced of his motivation, the jury acquitted him of the charges. History has a way of changing verdicts. 25 years ago, most Americans readily accepted the government's contention that the assassination was a random act of violence. A lonely young man, in his mind steeped deeply in Marxist ideology, apparently frustrated at his inability to do anything well, had crouched at a warehouse window and, in 6 seconds of world-class shooting, destroyed the President of the United States. When that explanation was announced, shortly after the assassination, the country was in profound shock. We had suddenly lost a very special leader whose personal attributes, freshness, youth, humor, style, intelligence, warmth, had made each of us feel renewed pride in the presidency. The whole country mourned as we watched the now familiar images of Lyndon Johnson being sworn in as president, the solemn funeral, the grieving first family, Oswald shot by Jack Ruby in the basement of the Dallas police station on national television. Saddened and outraged, Americans wanted an answer, and we got one. The Dallas police closed the case almost immediately, convicting Lee Harvey Oswald without trial. The FBI agreed, virtually closing the case in a matter of weeks, and the Warren Commission, appointed shortly after the assassination, added its official stamp of approval less than 10 months later. But time has undone the official explanation that most Americans first believed. There were too many contradictions, too many witnesses, too many photographs and motion pictures taken at the scene, too many skeptics. As time passed, previously unheeded witnesses were located, investigative reports of the assassination were found to be false, and other evidence was found to have been altered or destroyed. Even the concealment of assassination evidence for 75 years by the federal government could not prevent independent critics and researchers from uncovering gaping holes in the Warren Commission report. By 1967, two-thirds of the public did not accept the conclusion that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin. In the 1970s, the new Freedom of Information Act opened more doors. Material that federal agencies had stored away in their files, believing it would remain secret forever, became available to the public. Since that time, able critics have done considerable research. Many books have raised incisive questions about the official story and disclosed new and troubling evidence. Yet much of this information remains unknown to the majority of Americans. For example, we're going to go through bullet points here of his list of points. First, 5 days before the assassination, the New Orleans FBI office received a telexed warning that an attempt would be made to assassinate the president in Dallas at the end of the week. The Bureau did not pass on the warning to the Secret Service or other authorities. Shortly after the assassination, the telex message was removed from the file drawer of the New Orleans office of the Bureau. Secondly, the great majority of witnesses at Dealey Plaza in Dallas heard repeated rifle fire coming from the grassy knoll in front of Kennedy. In the chase that followed, the Dallas police apprehended 3 men and marched them away under shotgun arrest. However, the numerous news photographs of their arrest were never published, and no record remains of their mugshots, their fingerprints, or their names. Third bullet point. On the day of his arrest, Lee Oswald was given a nitrate test, the results of which showed he had not fired a rifle in the previous 24 hours. This fact was kept secret by both the federal government and the Dallas police for 10 months. For more than 5 years, this is the fourth bullet point, for more than 5 years, the film of the assassination taken by eyewitness Abraham Zapruder was concealed from the public and kept locked in a vault by Life magazine. This moving picture showed Kennedy being slammed violently backwards, clear evidence of his being struck by a rifle from the front, rifle shot from the front. Fifth bullet point. Approximately an hour before the arrival of Kennedy's motorcade, Jack Ruby, the man who later murdered Lee Harvey Oswald, was observed alongside the grassy knoll, unloading a man carrying a rifle in a case. The statement of Julia Ann Mercer, the witness to that event, was altered by the FBI to make it appear that she had been unable to identify Ruby as the man. This fraudulent alteration has never been explained or even denied by the federal government. Wow, that's very interesting. I think I heard someone else allude to that. Maybe they touch on that in the movie. Okay, the sixth bullet point. After the president's body was subjected to a military autopsy, his brain disappeared. The brain, which is still missing after 25 years, had been immersed in formalin to harden it and might have shown from what directions the shots came. Photographs and x-rays of the autopsy, which might also have resolved the issue, were never examined by the Warren Commission. Number 7. The pathologist in charge of Kennedy's autopsy at Bethesda Naval Hospital burned in the fireplace of his home the first draft of the autopsy report. That's the end of his bulleted list of anomalies and facts. Continuing on with the text, such revelations, while not widely disseminated, did eventually force the House Select Committee on Assassinations to conduct another investigation from 1976 to 1979. Its official conclusion, citing acoustical evidence, was that there probably had been a conspiracy to murder President Kennedy, and that more than one man had been shooting at him. However, the investigation was limited and made no further attempt to determine the forces behind the assassination. This book accepts the responsibility that the House Committee bypassed. Based on my experiences as a district attorney who actively investigated the assassination, and on my continuing search since then, I offer in the final chapter an informed historical speculation about what happened, who killed John Kennedy, and why. I do not claim, however, to have all the answers about the assassination. No individual could. To uncover the whole truth would require an open-ended, honest federal investigation, the kind that has not taken place to date. At the outset, I must underscore the fact that the details of the assassination, who pulled the trigger, from what building, what kind of gun, and so forth, are no longer my primary concerns. The assassination was an enormously important event, but even more important, in my view, is what happened after. Ratification by the government and the media of an official story that is an absurd fairy tale. Immediately after the assassination, the federal government and the major media adopted the posture of two giant ostriches, each unyielding to reason, each with its head firmly lodged in the sand. Having ratified the lone assassin theory, they refused to acknowledge any facts that might discredit it and attacked anyone who offered a different explanation. It was not difficult to figure out what their dilemma was. For the government and the major media to have acknowledged what virtually everyone knew, that Kennedy had been fired at by a number of guns, would have put an end to the sacred pretense that the president's assassination was a chance occurrence. To have acknowledged a conspiracy would have led inevitably to the question of why it had occurred. There then would have followed recognition that there had been powerful opposition in the government to President Kennedy's efforts to end the Cold War. His desire to withdraw from Vietnam, for example, would have been revealed. Correspondingly, the role of those who dragged us into 9 years of war in Vietnam also would have become clearer. When I tried to bring some of these profoundly disturbing connections to light, the United States government and the major media came down hard on me. Both before and after the trial of Clay Shaw, I was denounced by government officials and the mass media for suggesting that members of our own intelligence agencies might have conspired to kill the president. I was vilified in the press as a publicity-seeking politician, a charlatan, and a communist. The federal government brought false charges of corruption against me while I was in the midst of a re-election campaign for district attorney. Although I was found innocent in court, I narrowly lost the election. Thus, the government succeeded in its attempt to remove me from office. In the hostile climate of that time, it was impossible to communicate my view of all that had happened. Nearly 20 years later, that has changed. We have been through the Vietnam War, Watergate, and the Iran-Contra affair. We have learned much about our intelligence agencies and what they have done in our name. Assassination by our CIA is no longer inconceivable. It is established historical fact. The existence of off-the-shelf covert government operations is acknowledged in congressional hearing rooms and on national television. In this more open atmosphere, it is time, for history's sake and for the sake of the future, for me to tell the full story of my investigation and allow a new generation to consider it. As a result of my investigation of the Kennedy assassination and my experience afterwards, my life and consciousness were changed forever. This book is really about that process of change, of growing disillusionment, anger, and knowledge. My experience as a prominent player in the historical events prevents it from being typical, but our entire country shared, to varying degrees, my change of consciousness. A quarter century later, it is possible to see that the assassination and the cover-up by the government and the media were watershed events for this country. They represented the loss of innocence for post-war Americans, the beginning of the current era of discontent and distrust in our government, and our most fundamental institutions. I hope this book will help the younger generation to understand better the political, social, and historical consequences of the assassination and the subsequent cover-up. Today, we still live with those consequences. A continuing and ominous Cold War, a deceptive secret government, a docile press, a pervasive cynicism, and corruption. To bring an end to this era in which the lies of our elected government and the covert operations of our secret government threaten the very survival of our society, we must begin to see the Cold War and our national security in a new light. Our relationship with the Soviet Union and other communist nations must be reconsidered and put into a realistic perspective that looks forward to a new century rather than backward to the 1950s. In his short 3 years as president, John Kennedy had already begun to change our attitudes and fundamental assumptions about the Cold War. His adoption of a more enlightened, less polarized view of the Earth and its inhabitants, I believe, may have led John Kennedy to his death. However, it also showed us a way to avoid global catastrophe. In re-examining his tragic assassination 25 years after it occurred, we should not forget his enduring legacy, articulated so eloquently at American University in June of 1963. Quote, "If we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For, in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all mortal." End quote. Okay, we move on. Chapter 1 of On the Trail of the Assassins by Jim Garrison. Chapter 1, The Serenity of Ignorance. I was working at my desk in criminal court as district attorney of New Orleans when the door flew open and my chief assistant rushed in. "The president has been shot," he yelled. It was just past 12:30 p.m., Friday, November 22, 1963. Today, a quarter of a century later, I remember my shock, my disbelief. After I grasped what Frank Klein was telling me, I clung to the hope that perhaps Kennedy had been merely wounded and would survive. Frank and I headed for Totorich's on Royal Street in the French Quarter. It was a quiet, uncrowded place where they kept a television set in the dining room. On the way, the car radio announced that John Kennedy had been killed. The remainder of that trip was spent in absolute silence. At the restaurant, the midday customers were staring solemnly at the television set mounted high in the corner of the living room. I felt a sense of unreality as the unending reportage flooded in from Dallas. There was very little conversation at the tables. A waiter came up, and we ordered something for lunch. When it had arrived, we toyed with our food, but neither of us ate anything. The information coming from the television was inconclusive. Although the Secret Service, the FBI, and the Dallas Police, along with an enormous crowd of onlookers, had all been at the assassination scene in Dallas for at least 2 hours, the crisp voices of newscasters provided no real facts about who the riflemen or riflemen had been. However, we were hypnotized by the confusion, the unending snippets of trivia, the magic of the communications spectacle. Concerned with what had happened to the president and with our own hurt, no one left the restaurant that afternoon. The business and professional men who had come for lunch canceled their appointments. Frank and I made our calls to the office and returned to the television set. Then, well into the middle of the afternoon, the arrest of the accused assassin suddenly was announced. Approximately 15 Dallas police officers had caught him while he was seated in a movie theater a considerable distance from the assassination scene. The delayed arrest burst like a bomb on the television screen, and the long silence in the restaurant ended. You could feel the sudden explosion of fury, the outburst of hate against this previously unknown young man. His name was Lee Harvey Oswald. While Frank Klein and I were transfixed in front of the television set at Totorich's, a most unusual incident occurred at Guy Bannister's office about 12 blocks away, on the other side of Canal Street. At least, it was unusual for Bannister, a former special agent in charge of the Chicago office of the FBI, a deputy superintendent of police in New Orleans, and a man who had a lifetime reputation as a rigid exponent of law and order. I knew Bannister fairly well. When he was with the police department, we had lunch together now and then, swapping colorful stories about our earlier careers in the FBI. A ruddy-faced man with blue eyes which stared right at you, he dressed immaculately and always wore a small rosebud in his lapel. Although he enjoyed an occasional martini at the International House, Bannister had never been known to drink heavily during the day. He was an austere, highly composed individual. However, on the long afternoon of televised coverage of the assassination in Dallas, the ex-FBI man made a noble effort to polish off all of the liquor in the Katzenjammer bar on the 500 block of Camp Street. As the sun was setting over the nearby Mississippi River, he made his way back to his office with Jack Martin, who had been drinking with him. There, Bannister became embroiled in a heated argument with Martin, a sometime private detective and hanger-on at Bannister's office. The imbroglio erupted after Martin made an injudicious observation. He informed Bannister, during the course of their quarrel, that he had not forgotten certain unusual things that had been happening at the office during the summer. At this point, Bannister whipped out his .357 Magnum pistol and began to massage Martin's head with it. A .357 Magnum is not an ordinary handgun. It's extraordinarily heavy in order to support its increased muzzle velocity. The brief altercation converted Martin, in a matter of a minute or two, into a bloody, battered mess, and a police patrol car carted him off to Charity Hospital on Tulane Avenue. There's a note here, an asterisk. And it says down at the bottom of the page, Bannister's violent assault on Martin was memorialized permanently in New Orleans Police Department Report Number K-12634-63, dated November 22, 1963. Continuing on. Like a tiny seed, the planting of which went unnoticed at the time, that unusual and explosive act by Guy Bannister ultimately would lead to the only prosecution ever brought in the case of President Kennedy's murder. Stung by the pain and outrage of his injury, Martin, within a day or so, would confide to a friend of his injury. Jack Martin, within a day or so, would confide to a friend his murky suspicion that David Ferry, an associate of Guy Bannister's and a frequent visitor of his office, had driven to Dallas on the day of the assassination to serve as the getaway pilot for the men involved in the assassination. Now, if you remember the movie JFK, directed by Oliver Stone, David Ferry, I'm pretty sure, is the character played by... of course I forget his name now. The short mob guy who's in all the mob movies, Casino, Goodfellas with Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, that's his name. David Ferry is played by Joe Pesci in the movie, if you remember. He's got the goofy drawn-on eyebrows and rust, gaudy gold-colored wig that looks terrible in the movie. Let me read that last line again, just so we catch what was said there about David Ferry. I don't know if you caught that. Sometimes, for me, it's hard to catch things when I'm reading them for the first time. Usually I sit and read, and I have a highlighter with me, and I'll stop and highlight. Let me read this last sentence again. Stung by the pain and the outrage of his injury, Jack Martin, within a day or so, would confide to a friend his murky suspicion that David Ferry, an associate of Guy Bannister's and a frequent visitor of his office, had driven to Dallas on the day of the assassination to serve as the getaway pilot for the men involved in the assassination. Did you catch that? David Ferry was supposed to be, or was, the getaway pilot, the getaway driver for the men involved in the killing of John Kennedy. As Jack Martin sat groggily in the hospital on Friday night, the news scarcity from Dallas abruptly ended. Bulletins were cascading out of the television set. By the following day, the name of Lee Harvey Oswald had been repeated so relentlessly in the media that it had become a household name throughout the world. His resume was proliferating almost as swiftly, including more and more details about his stay in New Orleans through the summer preceding the assassination. Although I personally had no argument with the official lone scenario so rapidly taking shape in the media, I was not free to ignore Lee Harvey Oswald's unexplained 3 months in the city. The New Orleans connection meant that, however peripheral the effort might turn out to be, my office had to inquire into Oswald's possible associations in our jurisdiction. I immediately arranged for a special meeting of a half dozen key members of my staff. On Sunday afternoon, the senior assistant district attorneys and investigators and I gathered in my office. Such weekend meetings had become our custom whenever a crime on the national scene had leads trailing to New Orleans. In the course of checking out all possible associates of Oswald's in the city, we discovered that the alleged assassin had been seen during the summer with a man named David Ferry. I got my people on the telephones right away to investigate a possible Oswald-Ferry relationship. I had met David Ferry once. The encounter had been casual but unforgettable. Shortly after my election as district attorney, I had been walking across Carondelet Street near Canal. Half conscious that the waiting traffic was about to head my way, I began to quicken my step. Just then, a man grabbed me by both arms and stopped me cold. The face, grinning ferociously at me, was like a ghoulish Halloween mask. The eyebrows plainly were grease paint, one noticeably higher than the other. A scruffy, reddish, homemade wig hung askew on his head as he fixed me with his eyes. Well, just like I said, he looks goofy in the movie. I guess he really did look goofy. The traffic was bearing down on us as he gripped me, and I could hardly hear him amidst the din of the horns. I remembered that he was shouting congratulations on my recent election. As I dodged a car, at last, escaping his clutch, I recall his yelling that he was a private investigator. Our brief street encounter had taken place sometime in 1962, the preceding year. This recollection stirred up others. I remembered Ferry's reputation as an adventurer and pilot. Because I had been a pilot myself during World War II, the legend that he could get a plane in and out of the smallest of fields had stuck in my mind, and so had other vague fragments, his involvement in the abortive 1961 Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba, his anti-Castro activities, and his frequent speeches to veterans groups about patriotism and anti-communism. The name of David Ferry was well known in New Orleans. Soon, one of my assistant DAs, Herman Coleman, came in with some startling news. He had learned that Ferry had made a precipitate journey to Texas just 48 hours before, on the very day of the assassination. The source, whom Coleman verified as thoroughly reliable, was the man to whom Jack Martin had confided after he had been pistol-whipped by Guy Bannister. Martin had told this source of his dark suspicions about Ferry's sudden Texas trip. A routine review of our files revealed a police report based on a complaint against Ferry. The complaint, a misdemeanor, had been refused for prosecution, but the report led us to Ferry's present address on Louisiana Avenue Parkway. I sent Frank Klein and a team of investigators to the place. In Ferry's unkept rabbit hutch of an apartment, they found an assortment of army rifles, ammunition clips, military canteens, and web equipment, and, on the wall, a large map of Cuba. Adding to the general confusion were two young men awaiting Ferry's return. They said that Ferry had headed for Texas in his car early Friday afternoon, approximately an hour after the assassination. Their account of the timing was confirmed later by other witnesses who had seen Ferry in New Orleans as late as midday on November 22nd. This meant that Ferry probably had not been a getaway pilot as Jack Martin had believed, but it did not mean that we could regard him as clear of any connection with the assassination. I left a round-the-clock stakeout at his apartment to await his return. On Monday morning, Ferry appeared and was brought to my office for questioning. He was dressed, as usual, as if he had been shot by cannon through a Salvation Army clothing store. He looked every bit as disconcerting as when I had last seen him on Carondelet Street back in 1962. He denied ever having known Lee Oswald, but admitted he had driven to Houston early Friday afternoon. Considering his exuberant confidence at our last encounter, he was distinctly ill at ease and nervous, and the more he talked, the less his story held together. For example, when I asked him the reason for his departure from New Orleans only 1 hour following the assassination, he responded that he had driven to Houston to go ice skating. When I then asked him why he had chosen one of the heaviest thunderstorms in many years as the occasion for his ice skating trip, he had no adequate reply. Later, we would learn that at the skating park rink, he had never put on ice skates, but had spent all of his time at a pay telephone, making and receiving calls. We also learned later that Ferry continued on from Houston to Galveston, Texas, where he happened to be when Jack Ruby called there the night before he shot and killed Lee Harvey Oswald. Needless to say, these details hardly were forthcoming from Ferry when I questioned him. From his answers, I did not find anything directly connecting Ferry with the assassination, but I concluded that further investigation of this odd individual and his curiously timed junket was necessary. I ordered my investigators to take him to the 1st District Police Station, there to be booked and held in jail for questioning by the FBI. I was confident that an FBI investigation of David Ferry and any other matters even remotely related to the president's murder would be exhaustive. That faith probably was typical of most Americans in 1963. However, It was particularly strong in my case because of my background. My father had been an attorney as his father before him. Thus, I had, through osmosis, or acculturation, acquired a reverence for the law. Thomas Jefferson Garrison, my paternal grandfather, had been general counsel of the Northwestern Railway, headquartered in Chicago. One of the members of his staff, a young lawyer named Clarence Darrow, had caused my grandfather much displeasure with his inclination to rebel against some of the more rigid structures of the law. I have been told that Grandfather Garrison was vastly relieved when Darrow resigned from the railroad's legal staff to represent the socialist leader Eugene Debs. Darrow, as is well known, went on to become one of America's greatest trial attorneys. Ironically, as much as I admired my grandfather, I developed a high regard for Darrow's unparalleled ability as a trial attorney and his great passion for justice. For this reason, and perhaps because of his relationship with my grandfather, one of my sons is named Darrow. My maternal grandfather, William Oliver Robinson, was a most patriotic man. He came from a predominantly Irish family and stood 7 feet 3 inches in height. His two brothers were each 7 feet tall. He had no patience for fools or for anyone who did not believe that the United States of America was the greatest country in the world. Successful in real estate and the coal business, he stood straight as an arrow, wore a magnificent turn-of-the-century mustache, and dressed elegantly, having his clothes tailor-made and sent to him from New York. There were, of course, no tall men's clothing stores in those days. As one of the leading businessmen of Knoxville, Iowa, and undoubtedly as one of its leading characters, he often would represent the town at the railroad station when an important dignitary passed through on the cross-country train. When he did so, he wore a red, white, and blue Uncle Sam costume, including the stovepipe hat, exemplifying the patriotism of the citizens of Knoxville. I have a photograph of him and posing in this grand regalia, greeting President William Howard Taft, who had just dismounted from the train. I was born with that Knoxville patriotism in my blood and grew up in New Orleans, but the important formative years of my youth were spent in the military. I entered the Army a year before Pearl Harbor at the age of 19, and liked it so much that it became a surrogate family to me. After being commissioned a lieutenant in the field artillery in 1942, I volunteered for training as a pilot to fly grasshopper planes for observation of enemy targets. Following tactical flight training at Fort Still, Oklahoma, I was sent to Europe, where I flew in combat over the front lines in France and Germany. Like the other men in my unit, I had become an artillery pilot primarily for the adventure of it. However, I was also flying to support the United States government's efforts to defeat the Nazis and the evil they represented. I was never so conscious of this as when I arrived at Dachau the day after the infantry, supported by my artillery unit, took that Nazi concentration camp and saw the gaunt, starved bodies of the dead inmates piled high alongside the waiting crematorium with its great, heavily sooted brick chimney stacks. During my 5 years in the Army in World War II and another 18 years as a field artillery officer in the National Guard, I never encountered deception of any kind. To me, the Army was synonymous with the United States government. I should add that I was still in the National Guard and still equating the Army with the United States government when President Kennedy was assassinated and I had arrested David Ferry. Upon my return to civilian life after World War II, I followed my family tradition and went to law school at Tulane University, obtaining both Bachelor of Laws and Master of Civil Laws degrees. Shortly thereafter, I joined the FBI as a special agent in Seattle and Tacoma. I was very impressed with the competence and efficiency of the Bureau. However, I was extremely bored as I rang doorbells to inquire about the loyalty and associations of applicants for employment in a defense plant, so I decided to return to the law profession. My arrival in the position of District Attorney of New Orleans was something of an accident. Richard Dowling, the incumbent in the late 1950s and early 1960s, when I was in private practice as a trial lawyer, had been an excellent attorney in civil and domestic litigation. However, the administration of his prosecutor's office left a great deal to be desired. As a former assistant district attorney, a job I had held from 54 to 58, I felt a strong concern about that particular office. When Dowling ran for re-election in 1961, I ran against him along with a number of others. I was given no chance of winning. However, I thought my participation in the election might help one of the others who would produce a better office. For my campaign, I did not go through the streets shaking hands and slapping backs. I did not attempt to have rallies organized for me. I did not have circulars handed out in my behalf. I did not solicit the support of any political organizations. I simply spoke directly to the people on television. And inasmuch as I truly did not have any organizational support except for a handful of friends, I always made it a point to appear on television alone, to emphasize my independence, to turn my lack of political support into an asset. I ended up in the runoff against Dowling, unexpectedly received the support of the local newspaper, and in the second round campaigned exactly as I had in the first. To my surprise, and to the astonishment of a good many others, I was elected and took office as district attorney on March 3, 1962. This was the first time in New Orleans history that any public official ever had been elected citywide without any political organization support. Consequently, I brought to the city a brand new and truly independent DA's office. From the beginning, I chose my assistant DAs from among the top graduates of the neighboring law schools and from among the best of the city's young trial attorneys. There was not a single political appointment on my staff. Thus, we were able to operate without obligations to any outside individual or organization. I was 43 years old and had been district attorney for a year and 9 months when John Kennedy was killed. I was an old-fashioned patriot, a product of my family, my military experience, and my years in the legal profession. I could not imagine then that the government ever would deceive the citizens of this country. Accordingly, when the FBI released David Ferry with surprising swiftness, implying that no evidence had been found connecting him with the assassination, I accepted it. There's an asterisk at the end of the sentence. Let me read the note. In 1979, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations announced its conclusions, it stated that President Kennedy probably was assassinated, quote, as the result of a conspiracy, end quote. It acknowledged that one of the possible indications of a conspiracy was Lee Oswald's apparent association in New Orleans with David Ferry. Continuing on with the text, I assumed that the Bureau had thoroughly examined Ferry's trip and found it to be of no importance. It irked me a bit that the special agent in charge of the New Orleans office had issued a gratuitous statement saying that the arrest of Ferry had not been the FBI's idea, but that of the district attorney. It was an unprecedented comment for one law enforcement official to make about another. I might have expected such an observation from Ferry's attorney, but hardly from another government official. I had assumed that the federal government and I were on the same side. However, I ignored the comment and turned my attention back to the prosecution of burglaries, armed robberies, and other local crimes. Okay, that's the end of chapter one. Let me see if I can see exactly how long two is, because we might just continue on. I'm starting to settle in here and really don't want to end it yet. And you know what? I think we will continue on. We'll do another 15, 16 pages here. Chapter two, The Awakening. Nearly 3 years had passed. These were years of great satisfaction for me. We had rebuilt a bucolic DA's office into a crackerjack operation. The office had gone 3 years without losing a homicide case, and it would be 8 more years before we lost our first one. The pink walls and green pipes of the old office had been replaced with walnut paneling. I regularly attended the National District Attorneys Association conventions at interesting locations like Phoenix, Las Vegas, and Los Angeles. More often than not, I was able to get away from the office once a week for a lunch at Brennan's or Morin's or Antoine's. By this time, our military was deeply engaged in the war in Southeast Asia. Like most Americans, I took it for granted that our government had our troops over there to bring democracy to South Vietnam. Like most Americans, I also took it for granted that our government had fully investigated President Kennedy's assassination and had found it to be indeed the result of a random act by a man acting alone. Certainly, it never crossed my mind that the murder of President Kennedy and the subsequent arrival of 500,000 members of the American military in Vietnam might be related. Of course, I was aware of some of the odd contradictions about the assassination. It was public knowledge that most of the crowd in Dealey Plaza thought they had heard and even seen shooting from the grassy knoll in front of the president. Some of them had run up the knoll behind the wooden fence on top of it into the railroad yard in the back and had been stopped by men identifying themselves as Secret Service agents. Interesting. Undeniably, there had been some real sloppiness in the security system for the president. Everyone knew that the protective bubble had been removed from his limousine and had seen the photographs of the numerous wide-open windows overlooking Dealey Plaza. But these, I reasoned, were the first things that any investigation would have dug into. The FBI most certainly had done just that, and, as if that were not enough, the Warren Commission staff had inquired extensively into the matter for 10 months. The conclusion of these two weighty bodies, that all the shooting had been done by one man aiming from behind the president, satisfied me that the allegations about activity up front around the grassy knoll and in the railroad yard behind it were so much speculation. That was my view as of late 1966. I was happily married, father of 3 children, with 2 more to come, and I had a great job. I was quite content with the way my life was going and with the world around me. In retrospect, it would be more accurate to say that I was tranquilized by the very world in which I lived. Then one day, that autumn, I had a chance conversation with Russell Long, the United States Senator from Louisiana. The subject of Kennedy's assassination arose. To this day, I recall his words, quote, "Those fellows on the Warren Commission were dead wrong," he said in his blunt fashion. "There's no way in the world that one man could have shot up Jack Kennedy that way." I was surprised to hear this from one of the most intelligent members of the U.S. Senate, a man I knew personally and deeply respected. This was the first sign I had encountered that doubts persisted about Kennedy's assassination in such high quarters. The force of Senator Long's words aroused my curiosity. I immediately ordered the entire set of the Warren Commission volumes, the hearings, the exhibits, and the Commission's report. While I waited for the books to arrive, I did some research at the library about how the Warren Commission came into being. 5 days after the assassination, Representative Charles Goodell of New York proposed that a joint congressional committee conduct an investigation. The committee was to consist of 7 representatives and 7 senators. 2 days later, before Congress had taken any action to follow up on Goodell's proposal, President Lyndon Johnson announced that he had already formed an investigative commission and chosen 7 members. To avoid any possible criticism that he was taking the investigation out of the hands of Congress, he included 2 representatives from each chamber. Do you see what's happening here, folks? Did you catch that? I looked up biographical information on each of his selections. It was apparent that his investigative group was notably weighted with men whose backgrounds were pro-intelligence or pro-military. Alan Dulles had been the director of the CIA for 9 years. Representative Gerald Ford was described by Newsweek as the CIA's best friend in Congress. Senator Richard Russell chaired the Senate Armed Forces Committee and headed its subcommittee on intelligence. John J. McCloy had served as Assistant Secretary of War and the United States government's High Commissioner in occupied Germany at the end of World War II. At the time of his appointment to the Warren Commission, he was generally regarded as the unofficial top member of the American foreign policy establishment. There's an asterisk here at the end of this. Let me go down and read the note. Rounding out the commission were Chief Justice Earl Warren, Representative Hale Boggs of Louisiana, and Senator John Sherman Cooper of Kentucky. At the time, I found nothing questionable about the makeup of the commission, nor did I have any reason to doubt the honesty or integrity of these respected leaders. When the 26 Warren Commission volumes arrived, I immersed myself in the testimony and exhibits for some weeks, mostly at night and on weekends. This was not my idea of a stimulating project, but I did it for the same reason that, back in 1963, I had inquired into David Ferry's oddly timed trip to Texas. Lee Oswald had spent the summer preceding the assassination in New Orleans. This was my jurisdiction as a district attorney. Considering the lofty credentials of the commission members and the quality and size of the staff available to them, I had expected to find a thorough and professional investigation. I found nothing of the sort. The mass of information was disorganized and confused. The commission had provided no adequate index to its exhibits, although one was subsequently produced by Sylvia Meager, a prominent critic of the official version of the assassination. The number of promising leads that were never followed up offended my prosecutorial sensibility. And, perhaps worst of all, the conclusions in the report seem to be based on appallingly selective reading of the evidence, ignoring credible testimony from literally dozens of witnesses. The commission officially concluded, for example, that Kennedy's murder was accomplished by one man shooting from behind the president. This was not merely crucial to the official position. It was sacramental. Yet, I discovered early on in my reading that the statements of many of the witnesses at Dealey Plaza did not support the official explanation of the president's murder. Visualize the scene at Dealey Plaza, which he has a map at the beginning that he notes to go back and look at. Let me just add here, too, just for a moment, that the originally planned parade route was straight down Main Street, which went down the middle of that little triangle of Dealey Plaza where both Commerce Street and Elm Street fed into one under the railroad overpass, under that bridge that you see when you look at Dealey Plaza. And just coincidentally, just how the cards played out, they revised the parade route to go down Main Street, to turn on to Houston Street, take a right on Houston Street, and then take an extremely sharp, acute left onto Elm Street, which slowed down the motorcade quite a bit to go right into the triangulated kill zone that we might read about later. Maybe. We'll see. Okay, so visualize the scene at Dealey Plaza. The motorcade, having just made a sweeping left turn from Houston Street, was headed west on Elm Street. At the time the president was hit, the Texas School Book Depository, which the Warren Commission claimed Oswald did all the shooting, was well behind him, to his right rear. Up in front of him, somewhat to the right, was the grassy knoll with a wooden picket fence, creating a small stockade on top. There was a grove of small trees clustered along the picket fence. Also on the right front, but slightly closer to the president, was a concrete arcade. All of this was on a high terrace, high atop the grass-covered slope overlooking Elm Street. A number of witnesses vividly recalled noticing strange activities taking place in the grassy knoll area in front of the president around the time of the shooting. For instance, an hour before the assassination, Julia Ann Mercer, an employee of Automat Distributors, was driving west past the grassy knoll on Elm Street. Caught in a traffic jam, she found herself stopped alongside a pickup truck parked partway up alongside the curbing. She saw a young man with a rifle in a case dismount and clamber up the steep incline onto the knoll. The day after the assassination, I later found out, she reported this unsettling incident both to the FBI's local office and the Dallas Sheriff's Office. But strangely, Julia Ann Mercer was never questioned by the commission's staff. Imagine that. Lee Bowers, the switchman for the railroad yard, had a box seat view of the grassy knoll from his high, glassed-in tower, 14 feet above the yard. According to his testimony, a few minutes before the shooting began, he observed two men he didn't recognize standing behind the picket fence on the knoll watching the approaching parade. Earlier, he had seen an unfamiliar man driving a car around in the railroad yard behind the knoll. The man appeared to be speaking into a handheld microphone. In an affidavit given to the sheriff's office, J.C. Price, a Dallas roofing worker, said that following the volley of shots, he, quote, saw one man run towards the passenger cars on the railroad siding. He had something in his hand. I couldn't be sure, but it may have been a headpiece, end quote. I don't know. I'm not sure what a headpiece is in this particular context here. Okay, continuing on. Some of the witnesses, contrary to the Warren Commission's conclusions, not only heard shots coming from the picket fence, they saw smoke from rifle fire drifting up through the cluster of trees. Like J.C. Price, an even larger number had the impression that men had run from the knoll after the shooting, heading into the railroad yard behind. Joseph Smith, a police officer who had been a motorcycle escort alongside the president's car, ran up the high grade of the knoll towards the fence. S.M. Holland, the signal supervisor for the Union Terminal Railroad, described the shooting this way. I heard a third report and I counted four shots. And in this group of trees, there was a shot, a report. I don't know whether it was a shot. I can't say that. And a puff of smoke came out about 6 or 8 feet above the ground right out from under those trees. I have no doubt about seeing that puff of smoke come out from under those trees. I definitely saw the puff of smoke and heard the report from under those trees. O.V. Campbell, the president of the book depository, said the shooting, quote, came from the grassy area down this way, end quote, indicating the direction in which the motorcade had been headed once it passed the book depository. He said, I heard shots being fired from a point I thought was near the railroad tracks. James Tagg, a Dallas car salesman who was cut on the face perhaps by a glancing bullet, said, my first impression was that up by the whatever you call the monument or whatever it was, that somebody was throwing firecrackers up there. And the police were running up to it. Bill Lovelady, an employee of the book depository who was having lunch on its front steps, recollected the shots as having come from, quote, right there around that concrete little deal on the knoll, between the underpass and the building right on that knoll. I'm sorry, that's my southern Texas voice, apparently. Abraham Zapruder, who became famous for the home movie he took of the shooting, was standing on a cement slab by the grassy knoll with his back to the picket fence. He described the police officers running past him, headed behind the knoll area. As to where the shooting came from, he added, "I also thought it came from back of me." Forrest Sorrells, the local Secret Service head, was riding in the front of the parade. He testified that when he heard the shots, "a little bit too loud for a firecracker," he noted, he looked over, quote, "on this terrace part there, because the sound sounded like it came from the back and up in that direction." William Newman, a Dallas design engineer, had been watching the parade with his family from the curb at the bottom of the grassy knoll a short distance in front of the picket fence. Newman said this, "We were standing on the edge of the curb looking at the car as it was coming toward us, and all of a sudden there was a noise, apparently gunshot. The president jumped in his seat, and it looked like what I had thought was a firecracker had went off, and I thought he had realized it. It was just like an explosion, and he was standing up. By this time, he was directly in front of us, and I was looking directly at him when he was hit in the side of the head. Then we fell down on the grass, and it seemed that we were in the direct path of fire. I thought the shot had come from the garden directly behind me. I do not recall looking toward the Texas School Book Depository. I looked back in the vicinity of the garden." Elsie Smith of the sheriff's office was on Main Street when he heard the shots. He ran, quote, "as fast as I could to the Elm Street just west of Houston." There he encountered a woman who told him that the president was shot in the head and the shots came from the fence on the north side of Elm, referring to the picket fence in the grassy knoll area. Malcolm Summers, the owner of a local mailing service, recalled the moment when the shooting ended. He said this, "Then all of a sudden, people started running up the terrace. Everybody was just running around toward the railroad tracks, and I knew that they had someone trapped up there." One lady, Jean Hill, actually chased one of the men. She admitted that she was not sure what she would have done had she caught up with him. She testified that she saw the man go toward the railroad tracks to the west, quote-unquote. According to Hill's account, the railroad yard, up ahead and to the right of where the president had been hit, plainly was the destination of the men running from the assassination scene. "I went back again to the testimony of Lee Bowers, the switchman there in the railroad yard in the parking lot, and studied his answers to questions about the aftermath posed by Warren Commission attorney Joseph A. Ball. Here's an exchange between the two men. Bear with me. Mr. Ball: "Afterwards, did a good many people come up there on this high ground at the tower?" Mr. Bowers: "A large number of people came from more than one direction. One group converged from the corner of Elm and Houston and came down the extension of Elm and came into the high ground. And another large group, went across the triangular area between Houston and Elm, and then across Elm, and then up the incline. Some of them all the way up. Many of them did, as well as, of course, between 50 and 100 policemen within a maximum of 5 minutes. Mr. Ball: "In this area around your tower?" Mr. Bowers: "That's right. Sealed off the area, and I held off the trains until they could be examined, and there was some transients taken on at least one train." Mr. Ball: "I believe you've talked this over with me before your deposition was taken, haven't we?" Mr. Bowers responds, "Yes." Mr. Ball: "Is there anything you would told me that I haven't asked you about that you can think of?" Mr. Bowers responds, "Nothing that I can recall." back to the text here. The fact that at least one of the trains in the railroad yard had to be stopped by the switchman so that transients, quote-unquote, could be taken off, ordinarily would raise the hackles of any good attorney. However, the unperturbed commission counsel quickly changed the subject, I noted, cutting off further discussion of the accommodating train departure of these unknown men. I noticed exactly the same legal maneuver when Sergeant D.V. Harkness, the officer in charge of searching the departing trains, testified in response to questions by Warren Commission Counsel David Balin. And here we have another exchange. Please bear with me. I will try to read this clearly and not make it confusing. Mr. Harkness starts. I went back to the front, and Inspector Sawyer helped to get the crowd back first, and then Inspector Sawyer assigned me to some freight cars that were leaving out of the yard to go down and search all freight cars that were leaving the yard. Mr. Balin asks, then what did you do? Mr. Harkness responds, well, we got a long freight that was in there, and we pulled some people off there and took them to the station. Mr. Balin asks, you mean some transients? Mr. Harkness, yes, tramps and hobos. Mr. Balin asks, that were on the freight car? Mr. Harkness responds, yes, sir. Mr. Balin asks, then what did you do? Mr. Harkness responds, that was all my assignment, because they shook two long freights down that were leaving, and to my knowledge, in all the area there. We had several officers working in that area. Mr. Balin goes on to ask him, do you know whether or not anyone found any suspicious people of any kind or nature down there in the railroad yard? Mr. Harkness says, yes, sir. We made some arrests. I put some people in. Mr. Balin asks, were these what you would call hobos or tramps? Mr. Harkness responds, yes, sir. Mr. Balin asks him, were all those questioned? Mr. Harkness says, yes, sir, they were taken to the station in question. Mr. Balin asks him, any guns of any kind found? Mr. Harkness says, not to my knowledge. Mr. Balin asks, I want to go back to this Amos Ewens. Do you remember what he said to you and what you said to him when you first saw him? Okay, that's the end of the exchange, but let's continue on with the text here, what Jim Garrison says. This exchange struck me as remarkable. Here, Counsel Balin has just been told about several passengers using a departing train to leave the area where the president had just been murdered, and rather than ask more than a couple cursory follow-up questions, he changes the subject. Amos Ewens, another witness, had no connection whatsoever with the activity around the grassy knoll and the interesting occurrence of the timely departing trains. Balin never asked Sergeant Harkness for further details about the arrested men, particularly who had seen to it that they were taken to the station in question, quote-unquote. Neither at the Dallas Sheriff's Office nor at the Dallas Police Department was there any record of their arrest or questioning. Nor was there, so far as I could find, any mention of their names anywhere in the 26 Warren Commission volumes. Also never followed up was equally intriguing evidence indicating that there may have been men impersonating Secret Service agents around the railroad yard. Joe M. Smith, the traffic officer at the intersection of Elm and Houston Streets, was told by a woman Joe M. Smith, the traffic officer at the intersection of Elm and Houston Streets, was told by a woman that the shooting was coming from the bushes, quote-unquote, left the area where he had been stationed and went up to the knoll behind the stockade fence on top. His account, responding to questions from Warren Commission Counsel Wesley J. Liebler. Here's another Here's another encounter, more dialogue. Mr. Smith, he starts and says, Mr. Smith says, there was some deputy sheriff with me, and I believe one Secret Service man when I got there. I felt awfully silly, but after the shot and this woman, I pulled my pistol from my holster and I thought, this is silly. I don't know who I'm looking for, and I put it back. Just as I did, he showed me that he was a Secret Service agent. Mr. Leiberler asks him, did you accost this man? Mr. Smith, the police officer, responds, well, he saw me coming with my pistol, and right away he showed me who he was. Mr. Leiberler, do you remember who it was? Mr. Smith responds, no, sir, I don't. Back to the text here. However, according to the Warren Commission report, all of the Secret Service agents assigned to the parade had gone along with it en route to the hospital. The Secret Service was on record that not a single one of its agents was at the scene of the assassination other than those passing through in the motorcade. All of them were gone in minutes. This is very important. Let me just point out here that Secret Service protocol was violated and standard operating procedure was not followed in this story this day in Dallas. And they had no Secret Service agents on the ground. I know this from other reading and study that other people produced, particularly the series The Men Who Killed Kennedy, which I think is excellent. Now, I think Michael Collins Piper had the most unique thesis on it, and I think he did a great job. But The Men Who Killed Kennedy, go watch that on YouTube for free, or go buy it, even better. Get a copy of it to keep. And anyways, before I get too far off here, let's go back to the text. Let me start over with this sentence, make sure everybody got this. The Secret Service was on record that not a single one of its agents was at the scene of the assassination other than those passing through in the motorcade, and all of them were gone in minutes. This meant either that the Secret Service was lying or mistaken, or that the man Officer Smith encountered was not really a Secret Service agent. Sergeant Harkness's testimony revealed that when he first arrived at the rear of the book depository, even before his search of the railroad yards, quote, there were some Secret Service agents there. I didn't get them identified. They told me they were Secret Service agents, end quote. From Harkness, therefore, it became apparent that there was not just one, but a number of people purporting to be Secret Service agents in an area where supposedly there were none. It did not end with Officer Smith and Sergeant Harkness. I found that Gene Hill, who chased a man running from the scene, was halted in the parking lot behind the fence on the knoll. The man, who was wearing a business suit, held out his Secret Service identification for her to see. By the time the interruption was over, her quarry was gone. Are you guys catching what's happening here? The people in Dealey Plaza are following after the gunmen and going where they heard the gunfire, and there's men in suits up in the car parking lot or in the railroad yard, whatever you want to call it, up past behind the grassy knoll where the shooter was standing behind the fence, apparently. And there are these men in suits stopping people from pursuing the gunmen. Are you catching this? Let me continue on. Despite these indications that several men may have well been falsely representing themselves as Secret Service agents, or that the Secret Service had no idea where its agents actually were, the Warren Commission and its staff had simply dropped the matter. As I read, I realized that the Warren Commission and its staff were not alone in their unorthodox handling of the investigation. The Dallas Police Department, which closed its books on the case almost immediately, also conducted a highly irregular inquiry. For example, after his arrest, Lee Harvey Oswald was questioned while in the custody of Captain Will Fritz, head of the Dallas Police Homicide Division. As a prosecutor, I knew that recording of such questioning is routine, even in minor felony cases. Yet, According to what I read in the Warren Commission hearings, the alleged murderer of the President of the United States had been questioned for a total of 12 hours without any taping or shorthand notes by a stenographer. Nor was any attorney present. The absence of any record of the interrogation of Oswald revealed a disregard for basic constitutional rights that was foreign to me. This could not be mere sloppiness, I realized. A police officer of 30 years' experience, like Captain Fritz, had to be aware that anything Oswald said under such circumstances would be inadmissible in any subsequent trial. In my reading, I was also surprised to find how quickly the FBI had wrapped up its investigation, reaching its conclusion that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin within weeks. Judging from the plethora of loose ends I was finding in the Warren Commission's testimony and exhibits, such a rapid conclusion seemed incomprehensible. The more I read, the clearer it became that all the official government investigations of the assassination had systematically ignored any evidence that might lead to a conclusion other than that Lee Oswald was the lone assassin. At first, I did not know what to make of this, so I just kept reading. Then, one Friday night, I found myself reviewing the testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Allison G. Folsom, Jr., who was reading aloud from Oswald's training record. He described a grade that Oswald had received in a Russian examination at El Toro Marine Base in California shortly before his highly publicized defection to the Soviet Union. Russian examination? My ears went up. In all my years of military service during World War II, and since, I had never taken a test in Russian. Never mind Colonel Folsom's additional testimony about that how Oswald had done poorly on the exam, getting only two more Russian words right than wrong. There's an asterisk here. Let's read the note. I'm reminded of the man who said his dog was not very intelligent because he could beat him 3 games out of 5 when they played chess. I would not have had any Russian words right. In 1959, when Oswald was taking that exam, I was a staff officer in the National Guard in a battalion made up of hundreds of soldiers. None of them had been required to show how much Russian they knew. Even on that night in 1966, when I read Colonel Folsom's testimony, I was still in the military service, by now a major, and I could not recall a single Russian soldier ever having been required to demonstrate how much Russian he had learned. Soldiers ordinarily are not taught Russian any more than they are taught philosophy or art or music, not if they are really members of the combat branch to which they are assigned. The government's witnesses and exhibits had described Oswald as a Marine assigned to anti-aircraft duty. A soldier genuinely involved in anti-aircraft duty would have about as much use for Russian as a cat would have for pajamas. I read no farther that night. I had to digest this first indication that Lee Oswald, in 1959 at least, had been receiving intelligence training. I knew, as did anyone with military background, that Marine intelligence activity was guided by the Office of Naval Intelligence. Wondering what possible connection there might have been between the ONI and Lee Harvey Oswald, I went to bed. I did not sleep much that night. The next morning, I headed downtown to the seedy, faded sector of town where 544 Camp Street was located. I jotted down this address some weeks earlier while reading the exhibits section of the Warren Commission volumes. It had been imprinted with a small hand stamp. There's an asterisk note here. The stamp, later found among Oswald's possessions after his death, was the type available at any dime store. It had been imprinted with a small hand stamp on some of the material which Oswald had been handing out on the streets of New Orleans in the summer of 1963. Oswald had been spotted participating in several pamphleting incidents. In one, Of those, on August 9th, he was involved in a scuffle on Canal Street with several anti-Castro Cubans and was arrested. The Warren Commission had concluded from this and other evidence that Oswald was a dedicated and ostensibly visible, if lonely, communist who had joined the Fair Play for Cuba Committee to support Fidel Castro. Because of several inconsistencies, this facile explanation had never sat quite right with me. To start with, I knew that Oswald had stamped the 544 camp address only on his public handouts of August 9th. It no longer appeared on the subsequent pamphlets he gave out. So now I wanted to look at the place firsthand. Catty corner from Lafayette Square, I found 544 Camp to be located in a small, mousy gray structure built from a conspicuously unsuccessful imitation of blocks of granite. This modest edifice was called, I was later to learn, the Newman Building, after its current owner. The entrance at 544 Camp opened onto the stairs leading to the second floor. There was something familiar about the building, and it took me a moment or two to refresh my memory. Then I went around the corner, past where Mancuso's small restaurant used to be, and walked a few steps down Lafayette Street to the other entrance of the building. There I found myself looking at the door of what I had known, of what I knew had been, back in 1963, the entrance to the upstairs private detective office of Guy Bannister. Located at 531 Lafayette Street, the door had borne the designation Guy Bannister Associates, Inc., Investigators. So both entrances, that being 544 Camp and 531 Lafayette, led to the same place. And curiously, the name of Guy Bannister, which had come up 3 years before, had surfaced again. Bannister had died in 1964. About 9 months after the assassination, but now it occurred to me why 554 Camp Street, that address, had been stamped on Oswald's material for only one day. Somebody, presumably Bannister or an associate of his, had stopped Oswald from using the address on later circulars. And small wonder why. Guy Bannister hardly could have been enthusiastic about the young ex-Marine stamping his address on pro-Castro literature. Even though no longer in the FBI, Bannister had shared the sentiments of J. Edgar Hoover. I knew he was heavily involved in anti-communist endeavors of all kinds. A young attorney I frequently played chess with at the New Orleans Chess Club had told me how Bannister had hired him when he was a college student to find radical, or even liberal, organizations on the campus and to join and penetrate them. I knew further that Bannister was a leader of the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean. I had heard about this far-right group from a partner of his in the organization, an attorney named Maurice Gatlin, who lived in the Claiborne Towers apartment building at the same time I did. Knowing now that Guy Bannister's office was the headquarters out of which Oswald had operated, I began to understand some of the things I had learned about the Marxist-oriented pamphleteer. Whenever Oswald was going to hand out pro-Castro leaflets, for example, he regularly had gone to a local employment office and hired men to help him in his leafleting work. I found this out when I noticed that one of these young men shown in the local news photos handing out flyers with Oswald looked very much like the son of one of my fellow artillery officers in the National Guard. I called Charles Steele and learned that indeed it was his son, Charles Jr. We interviewed young Steele and discovered that Oswald had paid him and the others $2 an hour to hand out pamphlets with him. Oswald had told them that they had to do this until the news photographers departed, after which they were free to go. This recruitment method was highly improbable for a true Marxist group. Most such groups had members to do their leafleting, but almost no money. Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, by contrast, had no apparent members other than himself, but enough money that it could hire unemployed people. This was the first evidence I encountered that Lee Oswald had not been a communist or a Marxist of any kind. What appeared to be considerably more probable, now that I had seen the setup at 554 Camp, was that Guy Bannister, or someone associated with him, had been using Oswald as an agent provocateur. For what purpose, and under whose auspices, remained a mystery. You guys paying attention? You guys still awake out there? Oswald, an agent provocateur, used a patsy. If Oswald had been working that summer under Bannister, I reflected, that would help explain some other oddities I had discovered in my reading. According to the Warren Commission report, when Oswald was arrested on August 9th on Canal Street and brought to the police station, he immediately asked to see an FBI agent. Interesting. Why? Why would he want to see them? Oswald was separated from the other arrested men and brought into a private room where he talked with Special Agent John Quigley of the local bureau office. Later, Agent Quigley burned the notes he had taken during this interview. This is contrary to standard bureau procedure. Well, I would imagine so. Customarily, such notes are placed in the office file, along with the report of the occasion. Such special treatment for a vociferous communist seems inexplicable, unless Oswald was actually working with Guy Bannister, a former high-ranking FBI official who could have easily arranged for it. Now, there's an asterisk at the end of that sentence. Let me read the note. After Oswald moved back to Dallas, the Bureau also temporarily transferred Special Agent Quigley to Dallas. About a week after Oswald's Canal Street arrest, I recalled, someone arranged for him to participate in a radio debate on station WDSU. The subject was, essentially, capitalism versus communism. Oswald represented the left-wing position and duly portrayed himself on the taped program as a Marxist. After Kennedy's assassination, and less than a week after Oswald in turn was murdered, copies of the tape were sent to members of Congress as proof positive that a communist had killed the president. Could it have been Bannister or one of his associates, I wondered, who had arranged for the debate and taped it? Could it have been Bannister who sent those tapes to Congress? If Oswald was working under Bannister's direction that summer, it was clear that neither his pamphleting nor his radio debating were intended to convert anyone to the cause of Marxism. Rather, guys listening, they were designed to accomplish only one thing. To create a highly visible public profile for Lee Harvey Oswald as a communist. Certainly makes sense to me. It's all about the record. It's all about getting it out there in public. Creating a precedent. I turned away from Bannister's old office and looked across Lafayette Street, where the U.S. Post Office building loomed. Occupying an entire city block, it was majestic and timeless in contrast to its decayed, weather-beaten surroundings. The building housed the New Orleans Secret Service operation. And, I now recalled, upstairs was the New Orleans headquarters of the Office of Naval Intelligence. There's an asterisk here, too. Let me read it. This I had learned earlier from Guy Johnson, a longtime prosecutor in the district attorney's office and a friend of mine who had been active in naval intelligence in World War II and subsequently in the ONI reserves. Johnson went there frequently. The organization I had been musing about the night before in relation to Oswald's Marine intelligence training. Was it just coincidence? I asked myself that Guy Bannister, who had begun his career in World War II with the ONI, had chosen an office right across the street from his old employers. Just as much a coincidence, I supposed, as the location of his previous private detective office, directly across the street from the New Orleans offices of the CIA and FBI. Interesting. I walked down Lafayette Street toward the Mississippi River to look at two other addresses on the 600 block of Magazine Street that I had noted from my reading about Lee Oswald's movements. One was the Riley Coffee Company, where Oswald had been listed as an employee in 1963, shortly before his famous emergence on the city streets handing out circulars calling for fair play for Fidel Castro. You would have to be practically a stranger to the city to not know that William Riley, the coffee company's president, had actively supported the anti-Castro movement for years. As I walked around the small coffee company building, I wondered whether Lee Oswald had actually labored there as a second oiler, quote-unquote, as company records had indicated, or whether the firm simply had been his nesting place until it was time for him to fulfill his ill-fated assignment as an agent provocateur for Guy Bannister. I strolled next door to the other address I wanted to check out, the Crescent City Garage. According to its operator, Adrian Alba, Lee Oswald had spent a great deal of time there when it appeared to Alba that Oswald should have been working at Riley's. There's a note here, let me read it. Later, Alba testified to more than Oswald's visits to the garage. He testified in 1978, before the House Select Committee on Assassinations, that he had, quote, often seen Oswald in Mancuso's restaurant on the first floor of 544 Camp Street, end quote. The House Committee conceded that David Ferry and Guy Bannister were also frequent customers at Mancuso's. Back to the text. In his testimony before the Warren Commission, Alba described Oswald's interest in the rifle magazines there. It was not too surprising that there were plenty of gun magazines for Oswald to thumb through. The garage was not exactly a young socialist's meeting hall. Very much to the contrary, for years it had been the official parking lot of the local headquarters for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now, since the Bureau had recently moved to the new offices on Loyola Avenue, the Crescent City Garage was still the parking garage closest to the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Secret Service. Furthermore, the Central Intelligence Agency's offices, located in the dark gray building and known as the Masonic Temple on the 300 block of St. Charles Avenue, stood but a few blocks away. Here's another note. In the early 1960s, the FBI was also located in the Masonic Temple. Oh, boy. I know. Everyone can't believe what we just read. Okay, continuing on. Considering the proximity its members maintain with one another, it's hardly surprising that they refer to themselves as the intelligence community. However, it seemed to me that a man planning to kill the president would have to be exceedingly nonchalant to have chosen the United States government's intelligence complex as the place to spend his spare time until shortly before his lonesome strike. In most countries, under such circumstances, a serious investigation would have begun with the working hypothesis that the intelligence community in New Orleans had used Lee Oswald as an agent provocateur. At the outset, his extravagantly high profile as a supporter of Fidel Castro would have been understood in that context. However, it was plain from my reading that in the years since President Kennedy's murder, federal investigators never once had glanced in the most obvious directions. Similarly, the highest officers of the United States government appeared totally unaware of the concept of the agent provocateur. By the time I returned home that day, I realized I had some serious problems to resolve. The application of every reasonable model to the available evidence had left me with a troubling conclusion. That was the apparent possibility of a pre-existing relationship between the man portrayed as the lone killer of President Kennedy and the intelligence community of the U.S. government. That is the end of Chapter 2. I think we will cut this off here as we are over 90 minutes, and we'll pick up next time with Chapter 3, War Games. I hope you guys have enjoyed. This is Ted Midward in Caucasian Christian Communications. Bye-bye.
Directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone.
January 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address to the nation.
Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
November 1960, Senator John Fitzgerald Kennedy of Massachusetts wins one of the narrowest election victories in American history over the Vice President Richard Nixon by a little more than 100,000 votes. Alongside his beautiful and elegant wife, Jacqueline Bouvier, Kennedy is the symbol of the new freedom of the 1960s, signifying change and upheaval to the American public.
That all men are created equal.
The degree of mind and spirit that I possess will be devoted to the cause of freedom around the world.
Today, the proudest boast is FBI Melina.
He inherits a secret war against the communist Castro dictatorship in Cuba, a war run by the CIA and angry Cuban exiles. Castro is a successful revolutionary, frightening to American business interests in Latin America. This war culminates in the disastrous Bay of Pigs invasion in April 1961, when Kennedy refuses to provide air cover for the exiled Cuban brigade. Kennedy, taking public responsibility for the failure, privately claims the CIA lied to him and tried to manipulate him into ordering an all-out American invasion of Cuba. In October 1962, the world comes to the brink of nuclear war when Kennedy quarantines Cuba after announcing the presence of offensive Soviet nuclear missiles 90 miles off American shores. Soviet ships with more missiles sail towards the island, but at the last moment, they turn back. The world breathes with relief. In Washington, rumors abound that JFK has cut a secret deal with Russian Premier Khrushchev not to invade Cuba in return for a Russian withdrawal of missiles. Suspicions abound that Kennedy is soft on communism. Kennedy also finds himself embroiled in Laos and Vietnam.
We've got our difficulties there, quite obviously.
Unless a greater effort is made by the government to win popular support, I don't think that the war can be won out there. In the final analysis, it's their war. They're the ones who have to win it or lose it.
Early that fateful summer, Kennedy speaks of his new vision at the American University in Washington.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. We must re-examine our own attitudes. towards the Soviet Union. Our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortals.